All right, it's time for offshore money. Are we going to do that now, or is that cool? All right, brilliant, because, you know, we've been talking about this for a long, long time. It's also been in the news a little bit recently, and I thought it would be a good idea to talk to Paul Nicholson, who's from St. James Global. We've been talking about St. James Global for a long time, too, and find out about some of the things that you need to know when it comes to having your money offshore, how you keep it there, what kind of rules there are, what the regulations are. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Gareth. How are you?
I'm extremely well. Have you had a good couple of weeks? How are things going?
Yes, had a very, very successful 2 weeks with all that's going on in the world, in the international and local markets, and in particular what's going on internationally with all these recent changes that have been announced in terms of tax legislation. So very, very interesting times we are currently faced with.
So let's begin, because I've actually got a couple of questions from people who've been listening. And by the way, if you want to find out any more about the stuff that Paul and I are discussing here, you can always go to stjamesglobal.com. They will give you all the info that you need. St. James Global, an authorized financial services provider. You can find out everything you need to know by going to their website. Can we start, Paul, by figuring out for some people? Someone asked what the difference is between an offshore retirement trust and a discretionary trust.
Gareth, I think that's a very interesting question, because I look at you know, historically I've been involved in the international financial services business for the best part of nearly 30 years now, mm-hmm. And historically a lot of South Africans set up discretionary trust structures in various different jurisdictions globally, you know, areas like Guernsey, Jersey, Luxembourg, Isle of Man, Switzerland. And a lot of these structures in recent times, particularly over the last, I would say, you know, sort of 6 to 12 months, are now being seen by not only the South African tax authorities, but generally speaking, tax authorities globally, they're being seen as anti-avoidance schemes. So I think the whole dynamics are changing in terms of, you know, is your structure going to comply with local and international tax laws? Not only in terms of disclosure of those assets, but also in terms of the source of funds and the source of wealth.
Right.
So historically, South Africans have accumulated substantial amounts of assets offshore, which have been protected by these discretionary trusts. And of course, now tax authorities are seeing straight through them. So the general trend globally is for one to set up structures not under a discretionary trust deed, which can be seen as an anti-avoidance scheme, but as a retirement structure, which can be seen as being set up for a very, you know, a very robust reason, like retirement planning, as opposed to tax avoidance.
Okay, I think I got a better grip on that one. How do you begin? How do you start an offshore retirement trust? Can you do this yourself? What's the best way of doing it?
Gareth, a lot of these structures are set up by transferring assets either from South Africa using one's exchange control allowance. So that's after tax money. Mm-hmm. So you currently have a 10 million rand annual exchange control allowance, which can be exported, or should I say contributed, not donated, big difference, contributed to an offshore retirement structure.
Okay.
And it all boils down to, what is the intent? Why do you want to do this? You don't want to do it to take those assets off balance sheet to hide them from SARS. You want to do them to fund for your retirement. So
okay.
there are robust pension funds normally set up in areas like the Channel Islands, backed up by, for example, Guernsey pension legislation, mm-hmm. And they are being set up for for the sole purpose of funding for one's retirement in later years. So they can be funded from assets not only from South Africa using your exchange control allowance, but also from existing assets that one may hold offshore. We find that a lot of South Africans are still not quite aware of the fact that they are taxed on a residency basis in respect of their worldwide assets. So a lot of people that we come across hold assets in various different jurisdictions in their own names, which has a whole set of complications attached to it. So once again, setting up retirement structures, getting assets, existing offshore assets, out of your name in the form of a contribution out of your estate, saving you a 20% donations tax in South Africa, and contributing those assets into a retirement trust.
Because, of course, the government in South Africa are quite keen for you to save for your retirement, right? So they've made, you know, certain exceptions to the law in order to encourage people to save.
That's a very interesting one, Gareth. I think you're absolutely right. And I think if one looks at the UK, for example, where the majority of all of these final salary and defined benefit pension funds are in deficit. I was looking at a website the other day, and I think it's called cookham.co.uk, and it looks at all of these final salary schemes. I think 84% of these schemes are in deficit. And I think for this reason, most governments are encouraging people to take control of their retirement. And I think people are living a lot longer now, and there's more of a drain on most governments, you know, in terms of providing for, you know, for the people. And I think we've seen that in South Africa. So these retirement structures, generally speaking, are becoming more and more accepted by governments around the world.
Is it necessarily something to have an offshore retirement trust? Is it something that only very wealthy people can have? I mean, could someone who has amounts smaller than R1 million make use of these structures, or is it a waste of time?
To be honest, I think it's probably a little bit lower, and you've got costs attached to these structures. You know, we normally look at about £100,000 or currency equivalent, because it's probably going to cost you about £1,000 a year to run the structure and the same to set it up.
Okay.
So if you convert that into rand, that's a lot of money. So
sure.
I think, you know, the structures really are designed for people who are looking over the years to, you know, progressively contribute assets from South Africa into a hard currency for reasons of diversification, for reasons of, you know, sort of asset protection, probate, estate and succession planning, and generally speaking, building wealth offshore.
That is useful to know, because I don't think, you know, a lot of people necessarily imagine that this is the kind of thing that is accessible to everybody. But you need to know what the minimums are so you can make it work for you. And if it just isn't a viable thing, then rather find other ways to invest your money. What about the ability to, let's say that you put a substantial amount of money into an offshore retirement trust, are you able to withdraw from that, and what kind of costs are incurred?
Yes, that's a very good question, Gareth. You are able to access the funds, and I think this is a very specialist area of expertise, and one mustn't look at these offshore retirement structures in the same vein as they would look at a South African retirement structure. They're totally different.
Mm-hmm.
Guernsey pension legislation is a very specialized area of expertise, but it is a pension fund. It has a retirement age of typically 50. One can access money prior to 50 by taking loans from the trust. But yes, you have full accessibility of capital at age 50. So whatever you contribute into these structures, you can take out as return of capital or capital benefit payment on attaining that retirement age. And of course, when the member dies, those assets pass on to future heirs through a letter of wishes, not dissimilar to your normal discretionary trust. So yes, full accessibility to capital on attaining retirement age.
So I mean, it seems like an obvious thing to do then. If accessibility to that money was a concern for people, that clearly is not an issue.
Well, I think that's right, Gareth. I think the other issue worth mentioning is that a lot of people have assets in their own name, which means that in the event of their death, they potentially could be taxed up to 40%.
Sure.
By simply transferring those assets or contributing them into one of these pension funds,
wow,
they completely remove themselves from that potential inheritance tax.
All right. Paul, what about the Panama Papers? They've been in the news quite a lot recently. I'd be curious to know how that's affected offshore retirement trusts, discretionary trusts, people who've been moving money around overseas. Has this kind of driven people into fear and panic, or is it something that has just got people thinking a little more carefully about what they do with these trusts?
No, excuse me, absolutely. I think, you know, if you look at what is required now in terms of due diligence on behalf of the trustees, you know, the trustees will not accept membership on one of these retirement funds without doing thorough due diligence in terms of the source of funds and the source of wealth. So, you know, unlike in the old days where it was very, very easy to get, if you like, money off balance sheet by simply donating them to an offshore trust,
yeah,
you know, currently there's a very, very stringent procedure to follow. You know, where does the money come from? If it's inherited money, we want proof that a great aunt has died and left you money in their will, or if you've sold a property, we want proof that the property has been sold. Or the capital may have been earned abroad. So
in other words, you can't pull a Mobutu Sese Seko and funnel huge amounts of your own country's, your state money into these things, and no one's going to question it.
absolutely right. I mean, look, in the old days, money laundering, that's moving money from the cash economy to the real economy. Absolutely no ways. And that's just simply not possible. And also bearing in mind that these structures are set up in very, very highly regulated jurisdictions, which prevents laundering of money.
But they are also discreet, right? I mean, for a lot of people, they don't necessarily want everyone to know that they have money. So even if they have to reveal that to the authorities, and if they have to reveal that to the trustees and the people who do the due diligence, they don't necessarily want that information made public, which is one of the problems of the Panama Papers, right?
Correct. Look, I think you've got a whole new set of legislation called the CRS, which is Common Reporting Standards. Mm-hmm. And it looks at virtually every different type of offshore structure. It looks at bank accounts. It looks at share portfolios. It looks at hybrid companies. Quite interestingly, retirement funds are not a reportable event under the CRS. Mm-hmm. And also the fact that they are very, very tax efficient from a South African tax resident's point of view, ticking all the boxes from a suitability point of view. Any funds that are received back to the member in South Africa is a non-taxable receipt. So they're very, very tax efficient, and however, they are transparent.
Okay. Paul, two last things. The first one, how do you save yourself from all the duties and taxes that are associated with inheritance? I mean, all over the world, they find a way to take estate duties, to try and, when someone dies, to try and get a slice of the pie for a government here or a government there. How does it work when you have an offshore retirement trust for your heirs?
That's probably one of the big advantages of these structures, is that one can make the contribution and thereby getting the assets out of their estate or divesting themselves of the assets. And one can quite legitimately, you know, in their tax returns, say that they have made a contribution to a foreign pension fund. So in effect, what they are doing is they are transferring the assets out of their name into one of these foreign pension funds and removing themselves from what's called probate. And probate is are the procedures that one has to go through when they die, not only in the country of their permanent residence, but also in the country where those assets are domiciled. So there's a whole set of complications attached around probate, both in South Africa and abroad. And also on top of the probate fees, you've got the inheritance taxes, which these structures avoid.
Okay, and the last thing I need to know, do you foresee, because we'll catch up again in a couple of days' time for another installment of this, and I think we can drill down into the detail a little bit more, but I'm interested, do you foresee governments becoming more interested in regulating these structures, or do you see them taking a more laissez-faire approach in the future? Because I think a lot of people would like to have a forecast of that to know whether their money is necessarily going to be scrutinized more carefully or whether they actually are putting it somewhere that's quite safe and secure and beyond the reach of ever greedier governments.
Well, I think, you know, on a closing point, that's probably one of the most important reasons why one should be looking at these schemes, because, you know, in South Africa, if you look at a lot of the local retirement funds, if you look at the UK, a lot of the international funds, mm-hmm. you know, people are living longer. There's more of a drain on most governments, and I think they're looking at these structures in a lot more favourable light, and will continue to do so. There's absolutely no doubt. You know, governments want people to save for their retirement. And the other interesting point is that no matter where in the world one decides to reside, these structures have different trust deeds for different jurisdictions. You know, we tend to deal with people who are fairly portable, and they may spend time in South Africa, they may retire to France, in which case we change the deed from a South African deed to a French deed or a Spanish deed or a Portuguese deed. So very, very flexible in terms of how the deeds are structured, depending on where one might decide to live.
Paul, thanks very much for today. We'll talk to you again very, very soon for Offshore Money on cliffcentral.com. It's all brought to you by St. James Global. Have a good week. There we go. There's Paul Nicholson from St. James Global. When it comes to foreign investment, it can be very confusing as to what is and what isn't allowed. In fact, being a beneficiary in offshore trust was highlighted in our budget speech for 2016. And what happens to your overseas money when you die? There have been significant changes with regard to overseas funds, how SARS treats you if you're a South African taxpayer. St. James Global have the answers for you. They've been doing this for years. They focus on preserving and protecting offshore wealth, creating succession planning structures that tick all the boxes given all the changes in international tax legislation. Make sure that if you have money and you want to protect it, that those worldwide assets pass on to future heirs immediately without costs and without delays. Go to stjamesglobal.com for more information. That's stjamesglobal.com, stjamesglobal.com. St. James Global are an authorized financial services provider. You can always find out more on their website. Interesting stuff, huh, Mavs?
Indeed it is.
Yeah. Must be, you know, it's tough when you got $10 million and you don't know what to do with it.
I'm just thinking that I am accumulating all the knowledge I will need for the millions I'm about to make.
When you're very rich, you'll be grateful for this.
Yes.
All right.